Rustbelt Capital is an elite Ohio-based private equity firm with a specialization in long-term, high cash flow multifamily investments. If you're looking for long-term recurring income, you should check out Rustbelt Capital. From their approach to managing risk, to the locations they invest, the product quality they provide, this firm is serious about what they do, which is why the owners of Rustbelt Capital invest their money in every deal they take on. Review their case studies by visiting rustbeltcapital.com. That's rustbeltcapital.com. Once again, rustbeltcapital.com or email investor@rustbeltcapital.com.
So what a lot of investors maybe didn't even realize that were in fixed rate deals that sold early over the last several years, they thought they got really good returns because the property went up so far in value. They got this nice gain on sale. They got this big payout. What they didn't realize is that payout would have been way larger if they didn't have to pay the yield maintenance penalty. And it really was a massive hit to their bottom line.
Hello, left fielders. Welcome to Passive Investing from Left Field Podcast. Our community is focused on networking and education to help people invest passively and think differently. Let's go.
This is Brian Burke from Praxis Capital, and you are listening to the Passive Investing from Left Field Podcast.
I'm really excited to have Brian Burke with us again. He is the president and CEO of Praxis Capital, a vertically integrated real estate private equity investment firm, which he founded in 2001. Brian has acquired over $800 million worth of real estate over a 30-year career, including over 4,000 multifamily units and more than 700 single-family homes. He's subdivided land, built homes, constructed self-storage, but now he really prefers to reposition existing multifamily properties. Brian is the author of The Hands-Off Investor, one of my favorite books in passive investing, and is a frequent public speaker at real estate conferences and events nationwide. And most importantly, this is his third time on the Passive Investing from Left Field Podcast. We're grateful for that. You can check him out on episode 113 from April of 2023 and episode 3 way back in March of 2021. So Brian, again, welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field Podcast.
Wow. Well, I'm so happy to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me. It's kind of a funny story. I just noticed a little spider web by my web camera, which tells me how long it's been since I'm actually been on a lot of podcasts. And I think that's like a new index I'm going to invent called the podcast index. The more times I'm on a podcast, the hotter the real estate market, the fewer times I'm on a podcast, then obviously the real estate market must be dying out. And if I've got a spider web on my camera, that should tell you everything you need to know about the real estate market. But let's dive in.
Yeah, we'll go for it anyway. And you know, normally I would ask your journey, but we've talked about that before in the past two episodes. So I just want to skip that and dive in. Last time we talked, it was just under a year ago, and you said your job is not to invest people's money, it's to not lose their money. Now, in that time since you said that, many investors have lost money in this market. And I just am curious, have you been active in buying or selling? I think with the cobwebs, I'm going to say, no, you haven't. But have you been successful in not losing investor money?
I'm still successful in not losing money. Knock on wood. I'm going into my 24th year of investing with investor money in equity investments without having lost a nickel of it. 34 years investing in real estate. The first 10 years was with hard money and that sort of stuff. Never lost any of that either. So I don't know, you can call it 24 or 34 years straight without losing anything. Still haven't. So I kept my track record since our last podcast. But you're right. There are investors out there losing money and stuff. And you know, I'm just trying to do my job and not lose people's money.
Well, we appreciate that for certain. When is it going to be time to buy? I think last time also you said you were still underwriting deals just to keep the pencil sharp. Are you still doing that? Are you going to jump in and start buying at some point?
Nah, I don't know. You know, at some point, yes, but no time that I can see through the current lens that I'm looking through. I still don't like what I'm seeing in the market. So, you know, to answer your previous question, we have not been active as buyers or sellers. We sold most everything we owned in 21 and 22. I've got five properties left, which are comprised of about, I don't know, 800 or 900 units. And that's it. And we're not growing the portfolio, and the market's not going to allow us to shrink it either. So we're on, you know, ride out the trough mode, right? We got to wait until the next market cycle peak. We can sell the stuff we have. And when it does trough out, we can start buying more stuff to add to our portfolio and give our investors more opportunities to invest in things. Because right now, you know, they're knocking on our door going like, you know, what do you got for us? It's like, we don't have anything. And even if I did, I don't know that I could recommend that you would invest in it. So, you know, we're in preserve capital and watch and wait mode.
And what are you waiting for? What's going to be the sign that says, hey, it's time to start seriously looking again to buy?
I'd like to hear a little bit more negativity about real estate. I think for too long, it was the greatest investment in the world. And it was like the way to get return. And, you know, it was cash flow and wealth building and all that stuff. And now a few people are talking about how like, oh, my gosh, I lost money and I'm not getting distributions and, you know, grumbles and growling. And I want to hear more of that, you know, because we need to see a bottom, and a bottom doesn't happen until the irrational exuberance is gone. And we're just not there yet. There's still people saying like, oh, everything's going to be fine. You know, rates are going to come down soon and everything is going to be fixed. And, you know, it's going to be a great time to buy. And this is the bottom of the market. Now's the time to get in and all that stuff. And I'm not there yet.
And yeah, again, last time we talked about rate caps and the cost of those rate caps on the floating rate debt. Can you talk about the state of that market now? When, you know, will rate caps go down if interest rates go down, or is it more about stabilizing interest rates that cause the rate caps to go down in the market?
It's more about what people think rates are going to do. I mean, certainly if rates do go down, rate cap costs are going to go down as well. But rate cap costs already, you know, have gone down some, believe it or not. Even though rates haven't declined, rate cap costs have declined. And that's because there was a general consensus in the interest rate markets that there was going to be a decline. So I'll give you a great example. This is really current. 1 month ago, I renewed a rate cap on one of our five properties that we have left. And in September, so right now we're recording this, it's March of 2024. In September of 2023, I got a quote for that rate cap, 2-year rate cap on a $24 million loan, and it was $1,150,000. And then when we renewed the rate cap a month ago in late January of 2024, our actual cost was $1,015,000. So it went down about $150,000 for that 2-year rate cap. And the reason is the interest rate markets had felt that 2024 rates were going to decline and 2025 was going to decline even further. And it was priced based upon those forward curves. Now, what's happened in the months since is a couple of reports have come out about inflation and jobs. And now there's talk about how there's not going to be a rate cut at the next Fed meeting, and it might not be until June. Now there's talk about that, and then it might not come down as fast as people hoped. So now the forward curves are actually up over where they were a month ago. So the rate cap pricing from when I renewed a month ago is up a little bit. So it fluctuates greatly depending on what interest rates are expected to do.
And how does it work with the escrow on these? Because I understand that you have to prepare ahead of time and start putting money aside to pay for the rate caps as your renewal comes up. So again, I think things might have changed with everyone was thinking rates were going to go down. So if they do actually go down or stabilize, does that mean that people that have been escrowing a bunch for these rate caps might have extra cash to put towards the operations of the property rather than saving it for those rate caps?
That's a great question. And in our case, our lender had us reserve $1.5 million for this rate cap we just renewed. The rate cap cost us $1 million. So we had $500,000 left in the rate cap replacement reserve. Now, ideally, I'd like to say, all right, give me the money so I can distribute to our investors, right? Well, getting money from a lender is like getting blood out of a rock. That's never going to happen. So instead, what the lenders do is they keep the excess in the rate cap replacement reserve to apply towards your next rate cap renewal. And so now what happens is, and while that sounds like bad news, it really isn't the worst news, because what will happen now is in 2 years, we'll have to renew that cap again. Assuming that cap pricing doesn't change at all, it's halfway paid for already. So that means that the amount that they're going to reserve over the next 24 months is going to be a lot less than what they were reserving over the previous 24 months. And that's going to improve the property's cash flow. It could even result where we get into positive distributable income again out of that property, which we haven't had in a while because the rate cap replacement reserve costs got jacked up so high because they under-reserved early in the process. So just to give you color on that, when we first bought that property, they were reserving $800 a month. When at the end of last year, that was $189,000 a month. That's how much they boosted up. Now it's probably going to go into kind of, that $30,000 or $40,000 a month range, which is still really high. But we have the cash flow to support that as well. So, it's not going to be that damaging. In fact, it's a better position than we've been in a while. So yes, it is possible to have money left over, but no, you're not likely to get it back.
Well, and then you mentioned this, and we've talked about this before, and I really like how you phrase this. Investors have gotten used to regular cash distributions, right? Either the pref or just whatever, it comes out the same amount every month, and it's just expected. Now, you talked about distributions aren't supposed to be regular, right? They're supposed to be the cash from the net income that is produced from operations. You distribute it when you have something and you don't when you don't. So can you talk about the mismatch between investor expectations and reality of how this is supposed to work?
Yeah, I mean, the clearest way to think about this, if you're investing passively in a real estate opportunity, your distributions are essentially the same as what you would receive if you bought that property yourself directly, at least until the pref hurdle is exceeded. It would be no different whether you bought the property yourself. So if you went out and bought an apartment complex with your own money and you were running it, and that property is going to produce cash flow that you could take out of the property's bank account and put in your personal bank account, there will be times when that property will produce cash flow for you to move over to your personal bank account. And there would be times when it doesn't. And investing in a passive investment is no different. And so if you're finding that the distributions are coming like clockwork consistently, but the financials aren't supporting that level of distributable cash flow, then where's the money coming from? Well, if you owned the property yourself, you would know where the money was coming from. It was coming from the excess cash that was in the bank account for the property. It was probably used for something else or supposed to be used for something else, like renovations or cash reserves or whatever. But it's not. It's being sent to investors. So you just have to find out where that money is coming from. And you can, the first place to look is to look at the financial statements and see what is the actual distributable income from that property. And if it's not there, then you shouldn't be getting distributions. And if you are, then I'd be more concerned about that than if the property's not having distributable income and you're not getting distributions, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense because sometimes I look at it when an operator, especially in this market, stops distributions, I'm thinking, okay, that's a good thing because they're saving that capital for reserves for, interest rate caps or increased insurance costs. So I look at it as a positive, although it is disappointing because you do want your properties to return you cash, but you want it to be done in a safe way.
Well, that's not up to the sponsor, right? I mean, the property either produces cash flow or it doesn't. So what happens is, and I think, there's people in this business on both sides that aren't thinking about this the right way, right? Investors are like, hey, I want my distribution. And sponsors are thinking of it like, hey, I better send out distributions or I'm going to disappoint people. And whether that's coming from the place of, I don't want to underperform, I don't want to disappoint people, or from more nefarious sources such as, I want to make it look like this property is doing well because I want to buy another one and I want to raise more money and I want people to say good things about me so that I can get more money from them to buy another deal, right? So it could be sponsors trying to mask the true performance of the asset, and that's really concerning.
And I want to switch a little bit over here to capital calls. That used to be, a question you would ask if you ever had a capital call. And if someone said yes, you run for the hills, right? But now there have been a lot of operators who have had capital calls. So is that necessarily still a run for the hills thing, or is it so many people are doing it that it's like, well, you know, it's going to, I know Praxis hasn't, but it's going to be hard to find someone who hasn't.
Yeah, I think it's, maybe it's not a run for the hills thing, but it's certainly a yellow light. It might not be a red light, but it's certainly a yellow light. Because the question has to come down to, why did they issue that capital call? We're talking about an unplanned capital call. Obviously, there is such a thing as a planned capital call. But and why did they issue an unplanned capital call? What was the circumstances surrounding that? You really have to dig into it. You know, just the even the question was never a good question when somebody said, oh, have you ever had an unplanned capital call? No, we haven't. I'm like, okay, check. You know, that's the right answer. Well, no, that just means they maybe haven't been in business long enough. You know, if they've only been in business for 3 years, of course they've never had an unplanned capital call because they could sell the property in 10 minutes. Well, they can't do that anymore. So now an unplanned capital call made because the sponsor didn't raise enough money, didn't finance it correctly, didn't get the right capital structure to begin with. Those are all concerning. And that to me would be a light at least somewhere between red and yellow. As to how they got themselves in that position. If they did everything right and still had a capital call because the market just forced them into that position, then, you know, that might be a different story. So let's play this off in a couple different examples, right? Let's say a group buys an apartment complex with a bridge loan with a 3-year maturity, a floating rate, 90% loan to value, and you know the market's firing on all cylinders. You got 10% rent growth, and then you know they're promising a 20% plus IRR, and this looks like a great investment. And then 2 years later, it's like interest rates are 9%. The loan is coming due. There's a maturity, and the sponsor says, "Look, this is either going to go into foreclosure, or I can do a capital call and I can, you know, raise a bunch more money or ask for a bunch more money from you guys to lower the loan balance and refinance so that we can get permanent debt on here and we can ride this out." Now, is that a good call by the sponsor or is that a bad call by the sponsor? And that's a tough question to answer because it's bad because they never should have gotten themselves in that position in the first place. They shouldn't have financed a longer term play and on short term debt. They over leveraged. They weren't being very conservative. That's a very aggressive move to have high LTV short term floating rate bridge debt. So that would be a strike against them. Now the strike for them is to say, well, at least they're trying to do something. And, you know, they have a plan to get out of it. So you know, you have to kind of call these as you see them. And, you know, it's more than just, have you had a capital call? Yes or no. Okay, good or bad.
Right. You got to dig in a little bit more to those questions. That makes sense. I want to pivot now a little bit before we get to the community member questions and talk about debt funds, because that is something you're still active in. Rather than where in the multifamily, you're kind of paused on new stuff. Can you talk about the debt fund? Some are still paying, you know, 6, 8, 10%. Interest rates have risen. Are those still good places to put your money in? And why haven't the interest rates paid on some of the debt funds increased as general interest rates have increased?
Yeah, so we are still active in the debt fund space. That is true. And, you know, it's really a function of, you know, where rates are and where leverage is. And that's kind of like the big thing that's, you know, the good thing about debt funds is where we are in the market right now, debt funds are a great safety play because you're lower in the capital stack, right? Somebody else's equity is in first loss position. They get wiped out before you even get touched. And in this kind of a market, that's a really good place to be, at least in my opinion. That's where I like being right now. Now on the downside, they don't have upside, right? You know, it's not like a real estate play where you can sell the property for more and you get this big payout at the end. I mean, a debt fund it's an interest play, really. Now you can juice the returns from debt funds in a couple of ways. One is charge higher interest rates to borrowers. And there's debt funds out there that might be making loans at 12, 13, 14%. And they can produce relatively high rates of return for their investors because those interest rates are so high. The trade-off is those loans tend to be a lot more risky. They might be seconds, they might be mezzanine loans, they might be highly leveraged, either the borrower themselves highly leveraged on the real estate, meaning that your high LTV loans, or the lender themselves might be highly leveraged. I'll expand on that in just a second, what I mean by that. And the other thing could be that they're loaning to subpar borrowers, you know, bad credit, history of bankruptcy, and so on. And so the higher interest rates are the trade-off. That's one way to juice returns in debt funds. The other way to juice returns in a debt fund is if you're like us, we're making relatively conservative loans, professional real estate investors, good credit, low LTVs, solid collateral, because again, you know, our first job is to not lose people's money. And so, you know, those loans are going out at, you know, 9, 10, maybe 10.5%, where they were 8% a couple of years ago. So those rates are a little bit higher. But it's hard to get investors much over an 8%, maybe 8.5% return after the overhead without using some leverage. Now, what leverage means in this context is, it might come as a surprise to people, but when lenders loan people money, they don't always loan people their money. They oftentimes are borrowing that money from another lender to make loans to their borrowers. And those loans are called warehouse lines. And when debt funds get a warehouse line, they're paying lower interest rate than, you know, what they're loaning it out on, and they're working the spread. So let's say, for example, we get a warehouse line at 7% and we're buying loans at 10%. There's a 3% spread. And you can juice the investor's returns just like you can by financing your real estate investment, right? You've got your equity and your debt, and you can boost your equity returns by using more debt. Well, debt funds can boost returns using debt in this manner. Now, when they do that, it increases risk. And when they do it heavily, it dramatically increases risk. So you can, you know, some debt funds might leverage up to 80%, for example, and that's pretty risky. Because it doesn't take a lot of borrower defaults before now all of a sudden you're underwater. We have a covenant in our fund. We won't leverage past 50% just because, again, we're being ultra conservative. Now, the reason that we haven't gotten our returns up much north to 8% so far is because we haven't even pulled the trigger on the warehouse line. Even though we're only going to go to 50%, warehouse debt rates right now are so high because a couple bank failures that happened that were in the news not too long ago have spiked warehouse debt rates. And if we take out a warehouse line now, it's not really going to give us an incremental benefit that we're looking for. If we're trying to get our investors over an 8, our warehouse line needs to be significantly under an 8. And they're not. They're like 7.5 or so. So it's not worth the added risk. So it's a little challenging. If rates came down, that actually would probably allow us to deliver a higher return to our investors, which sounds counterintuitive, but it's just kind of part of the mechanics of how it all works.
Oh, that's a great explanation. Thank you for that. So now I want to pivot. And as we talked about when we were offline here, we did have in our left field investors, we have a private forum. And I asked who they wanted to have on the podcast, and you were the number one vote getter. And as part of that, they posted a bunch of questions they wanted me to ask you. So I'm going to go through some of those and appreciate just like we're doing the regular podcast, you give me the answers. And the first one was, and you've kind of answered this, but what's your forecast for 2024? We're talking multifamily here. Do you see Praxis doing any deals this year? And you kind of talked about this as well. What markers are you looking to understand whether we've hit bottom or an indication of a rebound? Or is it all interest rates?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank your audience for electing me to serve. I'm here to fulfill my civic duty. If I've been elected, I will be here. Anytime you guys ask me to come, I will come for you and answer any question that your audience has. And I'm humbled by the support, and I thank them. In terms of the question itself, I don't see myself being active in 2024, quite frankly. You know, I frequently am heard joking saying, you know, there's times to buy and there's times to sell, and there's times to sit on the beach. And, you know, this is literally one of those times. Like for the last couple of years, we haven't bought anything in over 2 years. It's been close to 2.5 now, since we bought anything. And, it may be nothing in 2024. I mean, I would have to have an opportunity come our way that was just something way too good to pass up, even despite all the risks in the market. It would have to be that good. And I just don't think that's going to show up. So I don't think so. Now, in terms of when I think we're going to see some recovery, I have hopes for 2025, maybe being the start of it. Now, I will say that I also don't feel like I have to be the first guy to buy. You know, the thing about real estate is when the market starts to improve, you can allow some signals to show that there's improvement before you jump in. You don't have to, you know, you can get proof and let it prove itself. You don't have to be the first guy to jump back in. So I might wait a little longer than maybe some others. Where would we invest? I don't think my answer ever will change, that we invest in markets where people are moving to and we avoid markets where people are moving from. Now, the challenge with that is right now we're in a reverse dynamic where the markets where people are moving from, i.e., you know, the Northeast, the Midwest, those markets are actually outperforming in terms of rent growth than markets where people are moving to, such as the Southeastern U.S., Arizona, Sunbelt states, Texas, and so on. The reason for that, though, is because there's just been an enormous amount of construction and new product delivery coming to market, which has swamped the market with inventory beyond what the influx of population is absorbing. And that's caused rent growth to turn negative in those markets. So funny story, like a couple of years ago, I was on a podcast and some guy in Ohio, aren't you in Ohio?
I am in Ohio.
Okay, but it wasn't you. It was another guy in Ohio. And he said, where do you think you're going to see the most rent growth? And I said, you know, surprisingly, I think it's going to be in your backyard. I'm like, I think it's going to be Midwest, Ohio. That's probably going to outperform. And I'll be damned if it didn't turn out to be right. It was a good guess, I guess. Those markets right now in the short term are outperforming the rest of the country because they didn't have the construction. And housing fundamentally is still a strong fundamental thesis. So those markets are doing quite well. But I think when you look at kind of tortoise and the hare, in the long run, the Sunbelt markets, I think, will outperform, you know, the more kind of Midwest and, you know, the markets that are doing well right now. But it's not time yet. And so, you know, we're going to wait for those things to turn around and then we'll be right back in those Sun Belt markets, I suspect.
Left Field Investors is a community dedicated to limited partner investors who are interested in building wealth through real estate investing. The community is focused on education, networking, and engagement with quality operators and partners. We provide tools, webinars, and a forum where members can discuss everything related to real estate investing, including deals, operators, investment strategies, and much more. Coming soon, we're adding a new tool, sponsor reviews. This will be a place where our members can rate and review operating partners to further help each other in our investment journeys. Check us out at leftfieldinvestors.com.
Hi folks, Ben Lapidus here, your host of the Best Ever Conference, dropping some exciting news. If you are a passive investor looking for a like-minded network and dozens of high-quality operators to personally meet, then you're going to want to hear more about this incredible new mashup. Left Field Investors is joining this year's Best Ever Conference to create the most exclusive combination of networking and conference content available to the passive investor community anywhere. If you're already an infielder, then you get access to both events for less than the cost of one. And if you're not an infielder, then what are you doing? Sign up already! In addition to a year's membership, you get access to the LFI Day at Best Ever Conference on April 9th in Salt Lake City, followed by 3 phenomenal days of learning and connecting at the 8th annual Best Ever Conference, where hundreds of operators showcase their best deals and hundreds of passive investors come to learn, invest, and party with each other. We have many masterminds, game shows, intellectual debates, pitch competitions, speed networking, partner hunting, almost 100 speakers, party after party after party, and the tail end of snow season in beautiful Salt Lake Valley. Be sure to claim an exclusively discounted price of $800 and join us in Salt Lake, April 9th through 12th for the event of the year. Check us out at besteverconference.com for more info.
You've been a proponent in the past of floating rate agency debt with a rate cap. Is that still your position? Where do you expect the price of rate caps to go this year? We talked a little bit about that. and with the possibility of interest rates decreasing. So I think we've talked a little bit about that, but can you talk about kind of why you think floating rate debt, if you still do, is still a good thing to do, even though it got a lot of people in trouble?
Yeah. So there's three kinds of loans that are out there. There's fixed rate debt, agency fixed rate debt. There's bridge debt that has a floating rate, and there's floating rate agency debt. Now, floating rate agency debt isn't talked about very much because I think maybe not a ton of like newer sponsors use it because they don't qualify for it in a lot of cases. And it doesn't cause a ton of drama, so it's not in the news. So it's not often very much thought of. So when people think of, you know, they read an article about, oh, these toxic floating rate loans, that's what's taking down the multifamily industry. What they're really talking about is bridge loans, because it's not the floating rate component that's really killing people. It's the maturities that are killing people. And well, not really people, but deals and their money. It's killing their money. Let's start with fixed rate. The reason I'm not a fan of fixed rate is in the world of commercial real estate finance, fixed rate debt carries a prepayment penalty called yield maintenance, where essentially you're guaranteeing that the lender will get all of their interest for the entire term of the loan. So if you take out a 10-year fixed rate loan and you sell the property in 2 years, you still owe the lender the other 8 years of interest. Now, that's extraordinarily painful. And I'm talking in the simplest terms. There's nuances to this, but this is the easiest way to describe it. That's very, very punitive. So what a lot of investors maybe didn't even realize that were in fixed rate deals that sold early over the last several years, they thought they got really good returns because the property went up so far in value. They got this nice gain on sale. They got this big payout. What they didn't realize is that payout would have been way larger if they didn't have to pay the yield maintenance penalty. And it really was a massive hit to their bottom line, but they never really thought about it. Cause it's like, hey, if you're making money, everybody's happy. Nobody's asking any questions. Well, floating rate agency debt doesn't have yield maintenance as a prepayment penalty. Instead, it's just a 1% exit fee. You can sell at any time and you pay the 1% fee and you're good to go. Now, the toxic one is the bridge debt. And so where you people get into trouble is the rate goes up, the maturity comes. 3 years is the blink of an eye in the world of commercial real estate. The maturity comes up, and now that rates are higher and rent growth is gone, they have no exit. There's no way to get out. They can't refi because their loan to value is too high. They have to do something. They can't just sit and do nothing. And so that's where you see properties going into default, foreclosures, capital calls, et cetera, et cetera. Now, on the less dramatic side, but still kind of scary side, is the floating rate agency debt, where we don't have any maturity risk. All five properties we own are all financed on long-term agency floating rate debt, 10-year floaters. So we have no risk of maturity, right? As long as we have enough cash to get to a better market, we'll come out the other side. We'll still have the property. We don't have to issue a capital call. We don't have foreclosure. We don't have to worry about all that stuff. But what does happen is our cash flow gets killed because we have higher interest. We have interest rate caps we have to replace and so on. Now, you have to ask yourself, which outcome is worse? Is it worse to have your cash flow get killed? Is it worse to lose all your principal in a foreclosure, or is it worse to lose all your gain to yield maintenance? I mean, there's no free lunch in commercial real estate. There's downsides to everything. Now, floating rate, long-term agency floating rate debt has one major risk, and that risk is that after you take out the loan, interest rates shoot up and stay there. And here we are, right? That's what's happened in this case. This is the one outlier where you have this happen. Now, outside of that outlier, floating rate is, to me, the best option in most cases. Even today, you know, if we were looking to do a deal right now, would I want to lock in my interest rate for 10 years at what's potentially the top of the interest rate market? And now imagine how expensive it would be to yield maintenance out of a 10-year agency loan at 7% when the prevailing treasuries are, you know, at like 2 or something around that range. It would be massive. So to me, it would be devastating to be in a long-term fixed rate loan that's originated right now, unless we were absolutely certain that we were going to hold that all the way to term. And we were comfortable with the fact that 7 years from now, we could be paying 7% interest rates, even if everybody else is paying 2. And we can't refi out because we got this huge yield maintenance penalty we'd have to pay. But on a floater, if rates go down like people think they will, I get to float my rate down. And I think that's a big advantage. Now, one of the reasons I'm not buying right now is that there's an inverted yield curve and floating rates are actually way higher than fixed rates, which makes it kind of in that we're in that one spot now where it kind of doesn't even make any sense to finance properties in any way right now. It doesn't make sense to do fixed. It doesn't make sense to do floating. It doesn't make sense to even buy.
Well, that was a great explanation. I haven't heard it exactly like that before, but just to make sure I understand, the main difference then between the bridge loan, which it says it bridge, right? It's a bridge to somewhere. The difference is the maturity, and that's becoming the problem where you only have a 2 or 3 year maturity, and then you got to do something where on the agency, you have 10 years to kind of work things out. Is that the main difference?
Yeah, I think if you zoom out and look at real estate in any 10-year space, you would probably find that the 10 years forward, the real estate is always worth more, right? So, I mean, if you look at like 2005, right? And then in 2008, the real estate tanked, right? It went down 50% in some markets. But by 2015, prices were back up to 2005 levels. So in a 10-year period, if you can ride out the 10 years, you can survive just about any kind of adverse market. What you don't want to be is you don't want to be painted into a corner. And bridge debt is exactly that. You're painting yourself into a corner. You're saying like, okay, we're going to improve this property within the first 3 years, then we're going to refinance out. But if something happens in that 3-year period, there is zero time for the market to recover and come back. There's zero time for you to come up with other plans or other options. That is where the primary risk is. The primary risk isn't the interest rate. The primary risk is the maturity. The interest rate will not foreclose on you. The maturity will.
Yeah, that's well said. So let me ask you this, another question. How many syndicators right now would you estimate are in technical default of their loan covenants, either the DSCR less than 1.25 or LTV greater than 80%, even if the property is performing on occupancy and net operating income? And would a lender foreclose on a deal like that, or are more loans going to be modified or worked out behind the scenes?
So I think that that's a difficult question to answer because there's I don't have data, but I'll tell you anecdotally what I think is happening. I think that any sponsor that bought a property from, let's say, 2020 to 2022, any time in that period to the end of 22, beginning of 2020, or I'll say maybe mid of 2020 to the end of 2022, any property bought during that period that was bought with bridge financing at the time greater than 75% LTV fits into that category as you describe. Their rate has gone up dramatically. Their maturity is approaching. Their rent growth went away. Their rate cap cost, replacement cost skyrocketed, if they have a rate cap at all. Now, here's the other kind of flip side on bridge debt. Bridge debt is a 3-year loan, and rate caps are generally for 3 years. So not all of these bridge loans even required a rate cap replacement reserve, because there would be no need to replace the rate cap, because you have to pay the loan off before the rate cap expires. So that means that there's no money to even buy another rate cap unless the sponsor has money socked away or does a capital call. So that's a big one that's going to start hitting people. Now, when you think about 3 years, okay, if I said mid-2020, we're now approaching mid-2024, it's starting to happen, right? So your 2023 people, their rate caps are already expiring. You know, anybody that bought in 21 is going to expire this year. And if they don't have any money in a reserve account, they're going to have a day of reckoning coming up pretty soon. So I think there's a very high percentage that are in scramble mode if, when they bought the property, their capital stack looked as I just described.
Okay, so from a limited partner perspective, do you feel there's a case to invest in multifamily right now in this part of the cycle? And then there's some caveats there. Cash on cash on most deals is way below the risk-free rate. Some deals still have negative leverage. Expenses, including insurance and property tax, are outpacing rent growth and don't seem controllable. So with all of that, it would seem like the answer would be pretty easy. Probably not.
Yeah, and you know, I told you before we started this recording that you know, I was humbled by the fact that your viewers voted me in, but I said they might not vote me in again when they hear what I have to say, because you know, everybody wants me to say, oh yeah, the market's going to come back, everything's going to be great, it's going to be a great time to buy real estate, but I can't say that. Let's be real. No, there's, I cannot make a case for investing right now. Now let me just say this. If there's a deal out there that can be bought, I mean, everything has a price, right? Can be bought at a price where it absolutely would cash flow above the risk-free rate. Even though the underwriting is for negative rent growth, it would still forecast to have a decent IRR and a decent exit. Then I would say, yes, that would be something you could invest in. But I highly doubt you're going to find it, because right now, no seller wants to sell at a price that would achieve that result with the cost of capital today. I just don't see it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Any insight into preferred equity on underperforming deals? There's, you know, ranges from 8 to 18%. The question is basically, how do they set those? And what do you think of the pref equity, the, I guess, rescue funds as well, happening right now?
Well, I think be careful, because as painful as it is for investors to be in deals that aren't performing all that well, imagine how much worse it would be to get into another one that's not performing all that well. So if there's a very clear path, I can see it. It's bad news for the common equity investors that are already in the deal, although there's already bad news for them. But it could be opportunity for the new investors coming on the pref fund. Let me lay out a case, a potential case where this may apply. Let's say that somebody's got a loan with a loan to value of 80% and it's coming up for a maturity and they don't have any way to refinance it without putting in, say, 10% principal pay down to get a new permanent loan. And the only way to get that money is to bring in a pref equity slice to pay the loan balance down and do a refi. Now, in that case, the pref piece might actually have a good risk profile because you're coming in at a lower LTV. So I would want to know, what's the LTV of the senior debt obligation and what would be the loan to value isn't the right term, but we'll say cash in to value or total money to value of adding together the senior loan and the pref piece. If you add those two together, what's the ratio to value that represents? And if there's a decent equity cushion behind you, then that investment could have some safety. Now, what would happen if things go south is the pref equity investors would take over the asset and then they would now be the new common equity holders with the senior debt. So you'd have to ask yourself, would I buy this property under this financing scheme if I were buying it for the first time? And if the answer is yes, then maybe it's a decent deal. The common equity holders that pre-existed, however, would be completely wiped out. I mean, so that's the downside for common equity folks, is when pref equity is inserted into a deal, they're now senior to your position and they will wipe you out if they need to take over the property.
And do you have any insight on how the rates of return for the pref equity is set? Because there's such a wide range, it seems like, in the market.
Well, the way it should be set is based upon risk, right? So the higher the return probably means the higher the risk profile. You know, maybe the cash to value ratio is really high and there's not a lot of safety behind you. Maybe the distress is really deep. It could be poor quality real estate. It could be a desperate sponsor that just needs to raise the money and will do it at any cost and will promise anything just to get the funds in the account and sort it out later and hope for the best. So I would be more concerned the higher that rate goes. But no matter what, you've got to look at the total picture. You can't just say, oh, pref equity, 18%, cut me a check, send me the wiring instructions. You've got to dig deeper than that.
Right. That makes sense. So if you were solely a limited partner investor, what is the minimum number of syndicators or sponsors you would want to invest with in order to diversify your risk, presuming, of course, that they all meet your investment criteria?
You know, the more the better, I think, as long as you can find really good sponsors. To me, it's less about quantity and more about quality, but quantity does count for something. I would rather be invested with 5 really high quality sponsors than 20 marginal ones. So I think that makes a really big difference. I right now I'm invested in about 5 or 6 different funds with high quality folks. And that to me is a decent amount of diversification. I wouldn't want to be all with one. I mean, the worst thing you can do is take all the money you have and put it with one sponsor, because you've now got a single point of failure, and that's not good. You want to eliminate your single points of failure. 2, 3, 4, it depends on your resources. I mean, if you only got $200,000 to invest, you can't really spread that amongst 5 sponsors with $100,000 minimums. But you could do 4 sponsors at $50,000 if the minimums are that low. And I would encourage you to do so. I mean, if you were opening up a brokerage account to buy stocks, would you want to only buy one stock, or would you want to buy, you know, 2 or 3 stocks or 4 or 5 that you know are going to be really strong companies? Or do you just go buy a S&P 500 index fund? I mean, that would be like spreading your money around 20 marginal sponsors, right? I don't think you do that. I think the number is a small number, but the quality is the most important piece.
And how do you assess the quality of the sponsors that you're investing with?
Well, one is, how long have they been doing this? If they haven't been doing this through a cycle that's, you know, an adverse market cycle and survived it and can describe how they survived it, then, I mean, to me, that's automatically disqualifying. The second is, look at what they're doing now. You know, how are they performing now? And it's funny because we had an investor inquiry the other day and was asking about our track record and said something about how, you know, I saw some comments where Praxis was getting some bad press because they haven't been making, they've missed their distributions or something like that, right? And it's like, you want to see bad press? Let me show you some news articles about sponsors who are losing their properties in foreclosure. That's bad press. Halting distributions, I think, is a prudent move when the market warrants it. So it's, you got to look at how are sponsors getting through today. This is going to separate the skilled operators from the unskilled or should never have been in the business operators. This market we're seeing right now, it's going to take a lot of people out of business, and it's not going to be too difficult for you to figure out which ones they are. Just look around at how they're financing, how much leverage they're using and how they're deploying that leverage, how their cash position is, capital calls. All of those things play a part in determining how competent a sponsor is.
No, that's great stuff. So the last question from the community is about the the Bridge Mortgage Fund that you have, and how can you just, I know we talked about it a little bit, maybe just an overview of what it is and how do you determine the distribution rate?
Yeah, so the Bridge Mortgage Fund was born out of a loan venture that I started 6 years ago with 2 partners. We created a company called Riverbend Funding. We originated about $2 billion worth of loans through that company before selling it to a publicly traded real estate REIT. Now, our business model at the time was we would originate a loan and then we would immediately sell that loan to a loan buyer. And that way we could recycle our capital continuously and make a return for our investors and for ourselves. without a lot of capital. We didn't have to have $2 billion to loan out $2 billion. We could, it could be somebody else's billions and we could use our millions. Well, we also got to see that the other side of the table wasn't a bad place to be. The guys that were buying the loans were doing quite well also. So now after we sold the company, we thought, let's go to the other side of the table. We can buy loans. And so we created the Bridge Mortgage Fund, and we began the fund solely buying loans from the company that we sold to the new buyer. And so we knew who was originating them. We knew the underwriting guidelines. We know what the box looks like. And that's, we've bought, I think $150 million or something of loans from them. I think close to $100 million or something have already paid off. And, you know, we're cycling through. We got about $50 million on our books right now. And that's been going really, really well. We got really solid deal flow. We're buying loans as fast as we can raise money, which is great. Now, in terms of how we elect the distributions, we distribute all distributable income to the investors, just as if it was a real estate investment. The difference is that these cash flow immediately. I mean, as soon as you get in the fund, there's immediate cash flow, which isn't something you see typically in most like value add real estate business models where you have to, you know, fix the property up and raise rents and this and that. This generates cash flow immediately. But it's only, you know, right around that 8% level. The preferred return is 8%. And right now we've been hitting just that. We've been skimming right along at 8%, in part because you get delinquencies in there that are a sap on the cash flow. And, you know, you've got to get those sorted out. And then you get paid back on the delinquent interest. And then you get this boost and so on. And so there's a little bit of that goes on. And that's just part of the business. I think when we get a little bit of a break from interest rates, we pull a warehouse line, we're going to see, our distribution rate should increase somewhat. Maybe we get into the nines or tens. But it's not the sexy, 15 to 18 IRR type business. This is more of a conservative cash preservation and cash flow play, not a big growth play or high IRR play.
Makes sense. And the last question I always ask is, and I don't remember if you're a podcast listener or not, but what's a great podcast that you like to listen to?
The best one out there that I've ever heard, it's Passive Investing from Left Field. And it's it's the best podcast that's out there. I think maybe the only other one, of course, I've listed Bigger Pockets. I was just on their 900th episode, their celebratory 900th episode. If you haven't heard it, check it out. I'm debating the real estate market with Jay Scott and Scott Trench and David Green. So that was a good episode. I was on their show number 3, if you can believe it or not. It was like 11 years ago. I was on their show number 3. Yeah, pretty crazy.
Well, that's interesting because you were on show number 3 for us as well. So I'll definitely get you back for our 900th episode if we ever get
there. I'm looking forward to that. Let's do it. Let's schedule it now.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, if listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what's the best way to do that?
Go to our website for Praxis Capital. It's praxcap.com, praxcap.com. You can also follow me on Instagram at Investor Brian Burke.
Perfect. We'll put those in the show notes. And again, Brian, thank you so much for being such a good sport and giving us so much of your time. We appreciate it.
Anytime.
Thank you. Have a deal in mind and a group of investors ready to go? Use TribeVest to pool your capital together through a multi-member LLC. TribeVest has streamlined the group investment process, making it easy, quick, and safe to do business with others. Start a tribe and invite your partners to join. Then you can use the platform to collaborate with your partners, pool capital, and manage your joint investments. I'm in 12 tribes myself. It is a great way to learn from others, spread risk, and get into deals at lower minimums. Go to TribeVest.com to get started today. Hello, left fielders. At LFI, you know our focus is on networking and education. Mark your calendars because we're going to have a full day of it dedicated to you, our limited partners, at the Best Ever Conference on April 9th in Salt Lake City. LFI is opening the BEC with Passive Investing with Left Field Investors, an event focused on passive investors. This will be where insightful content meets passionate limited partners. If you enjoyed BEC last year and the meetup in Left Field this year, then imagine them both back to back. The Best Ever Conference isn't just any event. It's the premier conference for commercial real estate investors and operators. Your ticket to Passive Investing with Left Field Investors includes admission to the entire Best Ever Conference from April 9th through the 12th. Join us April 9th, where we will have a packed agenda with sessions focused on how to be a successful limited partner led by experienced LPs, top operators, and partners. Then, immerse yourself in the full Best Ever Conference, where you will be surrounded by like-minded investors, operators, and industry experts for unparalleled opportunities for learning and networking. The best part, and there are so many, but the best part, you won't find a bigger discount on the regular ticket price than the one you get for being an infielder. That's more content for an exclusive lower price. Register for the event today at leftfieldinvestors.com/BEC, and we will see you at Passive Investing with Left Field Investors at the BEC. Wow, that was phenomenal, and I know it went a little longer than normal, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here on my summary because, you know, if you want to know what he said, I recommend go back and listen to it again, and then go back and listen to it again. That's what I'll be doing because Brian really brings some great stuff. You know, the key thing that stuck out to me was just a great explanation of the difference between, you know, the bridge debt and flexible or adjustable agency debt. And it's really the maturity, right? The bridge debt is 2 or 3 years. So if something goes wrong, i.e. interest rate spike or insurance cost spike or whatever happens, you have no flexibility. Now, yeah, you might get a 1 or 2 year extensions if you've negotiated that up front, but agency adjustable debt, yes, you still have the interest rate issue, but you have 10 years to work it out. And that's why there's a lot of issues that are coming up over the next few years, because as Brian said, people who got into loans, bridge debt 2 years ago or a year and a half ago or 3 years ago, those are all going to start coming due and there's going to be trouble. And so that's why he's a fan of agency adjustable debt rather than the fixed where there's those big prepayment penalties. So I just thought that was a great explanation. And again, we talked about distributions and I've said this a number of times that I learned from Brian, you know, is that it makes sense. Distributions are supposed to be excess cash from operations. So if you don't have excess cash from your operations and you're making distributions, where is that money coming from? And that's the question you need to ask, because that money is not coming from operations. So they're distributing either reserves or they overraised or whatever it is. And it's fine. You just got to understand what it is so you know what you're doing and know what you're investing in. And then, you know, I think it's interesting that Brian hasn't bought anything in the last couple of years. And how many operators can do that? Just sit on the sidelines and wait. And that just shows you that their operation is solid enough that they aren't required to go out and buy properties to get the acquisition fee to pay their employees. Now, maybe this debt fund helps cover their expenses, but it's just a different approach to real estate. And it means that he does not feel any pressure at all to buy anything. He's not even sure he's going to buy anything this year, maybe in 2025, you said. And then talking about, you know, he's a passive investor himself. The more quality sponsors, the better. And he used the analogy of an index fund. You're just getting a little bit of everything. But if you go and find the quality sponsors, and man, is it going to be easier to find quality sponsors over the next few years than it has been in the past? In the past, everyone looked great. Everyone was having these killer numbers, and anyone could make money doing this. Well, now, a year from now, 2 years from now, you're going to be able to look back and say, okay, who was able to ride through this storm? And let's go with those operators. So that's what I'm looking forward to, is once we get through this, we'll be able to see who was successful. And I don't just mean who didn't do capital calls. You got to dig in and find out what that means if you did a capital call or not. But you're going to be able to find out what operators were there and had quality communications, quality operations, and were really concerned about investors over this difficult time. And then finally, you know, Brian and I were closing up. We unfortunately didn't record this part, but, you know, one of his things was lessons learned, right? I've been searching for lessons learned on some of these deals that haven't gone great. And one of his things was, you know, you don't chase IRR. And if you do, you know, we were talking about maybe you put that in your speculation bucket, right? Because 90, 95% of your portfolio should be investments. Well, then you can have 5 or 10% of speculation. And I've always thought, well, speculation isn't really something I do in real estate. It's more something I do outside of real estate. But maybe there's an operator that you just want to try out that's doing something a little bit different. And instead of going all in with them, you just do 1 or 2 small investments with them, call it speculation. And if you win, great, you get these huge returns. And if you lose, well, that was in your speculation bucket, and that's what that's for anyway. So just interesting concept. And I love talking to Brian because he's got, you know, strong opinions, and it all seems to make sense to me. He's a conservative guy, but if you invest with him, it seems like you're in pretty good hands. So really appreciate Brian being part of the community and jumping on and doing the podcast with us. That's all we have for this time. We'll catch you next time in the left field.
Thanks for hanging out in the left field with us today. If you are interested in becoming a left fielder, you can find us on the World Wide Web at www.leftfieldinvestor.com and click the subscribe button to join our community. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the show on your podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you really enjoyed the show, a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the podcast would be appreciated.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said on the show should be considered financial advice. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Passive Investing from Left Field and Left Field Investors. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.